Hey, what's going on, all you metal listeners out there? This is
Into the Combine.
What's going on, all you metalheads? I am Shoddy.
Jason.
Stan the Man.
And this is another episode of Into the Combine. I guess we should just break it down real quick so I can get into what we're doing this week.
Yes.
So that breakdown of the week was Converge, My Unsaid Everything from You Fail Me, from When Forever Comes Crashing.
There you go. That's a good fumble recovery.
What are we doing this week?
Now, breaking down the week, we're going to do the first side. I guess you can call it the first side.
Pre-2000s.
The pre-2000 metal bracket. We're going to keep going with that.
March metal bracket in April.
A little discussion of the basis in metal. And that's kind of segue into an interview that we have with...
Yeah, Nick, the bassist from Job for a Cowboy. Also from Cephalic Carnage and also of Havoc. So we are just going to talk about a little bit of some of our favorite bassists and mostly more like extreme metal, not really like, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, there's... Whatever, we'll metal, talk about I guess. It in a second when we get to that because it's...
I would say anything goes.
Bassist, okay. But yeah. I mean, I love them, but like... There's
I want to do this to show that there's some freaking
exactly.
phenomenal bassists,
yeah.
though.
And the ones that we were going to talk about, you know, have all the love in the world for me and aren't just the fucking bassists that I was talking about before. Because, yeah, so...
So, what have you guys been listening to?
I mean, I haven't really listened to it much. Just a couple songs. That new Caliban CD came out.
Oh, yeah
Caliban, or I don't know how it's pronounced.
I think it's Caliban.
Gravity.
That was like the melodic hardcore kind of thing, right?
It's like German metalcore. It's like very generic.
But they do
it really well. I've always liked that band.
Yeah, there's, I mean...
Okay.
Yeah. That would be my one, I guess, the one gripe.
It's very generic,
but they do generic well. Like, they're true to what they are, so... into a couple songs. I liked what I heard, but like Stan said, I mean, it's nothing that we're not expecting from them.
Exactly, yeah.
So,
but they got cool riffs, and you
they
know,
do. Yeah,
it's
I mean,
not bad.
I mean, who knows? I mean, in the next episode, I'll talk about it a little bit more. I mean, I really do want to listen to it more because I really only listened to a couple songs. But what I liked, what I heard, I had liked. So,
I did play a song or two, mm-hmm. and I think it's what I found myself saying it was just like a little bit too generic to invest in.
Yeah.
But it wasn't bad.
It's just been a while since I've listened to mm-hmm. anything from them, and I had loved them so much back in the day. So yeah. You know, I'm just kind of paying the tribute. Yeah, yeah. It's nostalgia, and it's good times, good memories, good friends. So that's why I want to, you know, hear what they have going on.
I feel you with that. I don't know. This one came out this year also. It went by me. I saw a review, I wrote it down, and then I just went back to it like last week, and it's called Oceans of Slumber. And category would be just like progressive metal. Very, very unique. If you're a fan of Opeth, I would recommend it. But a much lighter Opeth, though. Like, it's a female vocalist, which is funny.
I was just going to ask, how's the vocals?
Yeah, well, that's one of the best things about it. She's really, really good. And this is funny, because it's not like I'm sexist. I just don't usually find myself gravitating towards female vocalists that often. But I did it the other episode for Agoraphobic Nosebleed. Mm-hmm. And then now I found myself doing it again for this one. I don't know. There's definitely some good death vocals in here. But she's also a really good clean singer. But I wouldn't be surprised if this album got thrown onto some of the end of the year lists. Like, it's definitely really, a really good album. I looked up a couple of reviews. People were definitely digging it. And it's just something different. It's something new. The vocals are really, really good. And the instruments, everything, songwriting is fantastic.
Oh, I have to check it out. It looks a little short, though. 5 songs? Am I looking at the right thing? No, okay. I might just be looking at some EP or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of songs. There's a lot of interludes, and then there's long songs.
What did you say the album was called one more time?
Winter, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's called Winter. But if you're a fan of progressive metal, like especially in the vein of like Watershed, Opeth, but not quite as much of those vocals, but if you're just, you know what I mean? If you're kind of an adventurous, want to hear something different, like it's very good. It's very good. Stumbled across in some other review you're getting me confused with Caliban. This one's called Cobalt.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yes, dude. Easy with the C's. They I don't know, very unique again, like Skeleton Witch kind of vocals, where you've got like the black metal vocals mixed with a lot of shit. Like they take like southern rock riffs, sludgy riffs, doomy riffs, and then also like thrash parts, and they kind of like throw it all into one. It's a pretty long album, but I actually really liked it. It's not like the most catchy of albums where you're gonna walk away remembering all the parts, but just like a lot of cool riffs. So I'm gonna play an intro just for this one, just give you a little feel for this one. We'll be right back. Anyways, long songs. Eclipse not gonna do that one justice too much, but very raw. Like those vocals are very, very raw.
See, it had the heavy southern influenced feel, but I feel like with that kind of stuff, you need like aggressive in your face.
It's all a buildup, kind of like,
okay,
you know, maybe like Neurosis kind of stuff, where it's like a big build and then you get that like cathartic release, especially with those kind of vocals. I know what you mean. I don't know. It works for me though. Mm-hmm. It works for me. It does. It's more of like a journey kind of a thing where those songs are long and you get the ups and downs and like that kind of intro. I mean, that might not be in another couple of songs. You may not even get that like southerny kind of feel, but I don't know, dude. It did a lot for me. I definitely liked it. But that's about it for me.
Okay. Jumping into the pre-2000 metal bracket then. Starting right at the top, we have... it's Cannibal Corpse.
Is Tomb of the Mutilated.
Okay, all right. And then...
At the Gates.
Slaughter of the Soul.
Slaughter of the Soul.
Okay. Next, we have Entombed, Left Hand Path. And this is Deicide Legion?
Deicide
Legion. Who am I going to give this to?
I'm going to give it to... I think I'm going to go Legion.
Really? Left Hand Path for sure.
I think I'm going to have to do Legion as well.
I like Deicide, but Entombed is like by far much for me. And then we got Repulsion, Horrified versus Converge, Went Forever.
This is one of the weird ones where the random. It's hard to compare those.
I got to go Converge for sure.
I think I'm going to have to go Converge as well.
I would too.
Yeah. And then we've got Ulver.
Natin's Madrigal.
I'm glad you had that.
Versus Cryptopsy, None So Vile.
None So Vile.
Yeah, None So Vile as well.
I wanted Ulver on that one.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, you're
really
out.
Good black metal.
I don't know. Ulver was never a band I just spent time on, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe I need to. Then we got In Flames, Lunar Strain versus Children of Bodom, Hatebreed. Now, why'd you pick Lunar Strain?
I was going to pick the Just Erase, but I like Lunar Strain better.
You do?
I think I do, yeah.
What the fuck?
I'm going to go Children of Bodom.
I don't know. You threw me off with that. I mean...
Yeah. I mean, if it would have been the Just Erase, I still would have picked Children of Bodom.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I still would have picked Children of Bodom.
I like Lunar Strain, but I think maybe Hatebreeder is probably a little bit better done overall.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Lunar Strain's good, but I would have picked a different album. Yeah, Refuse, The Shape of Punk to Come versus Shai Hulud, Hearts Once. What is it?
That's a good matchup.
That's Refused for me.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Not even going to talk anymore.
Dark Tranquility, The Gallery versus Napalm Death, Scum. That's such a bad matchup.
The Gallery.
We should say again, this is randomly generated matchups.
Yeah.
For anybody who hasn't listened to the other ones. So these are not, we didn't match them up based on like.
No.
The type of band. And these are also just random bands that Stan picked out. You know, these aren't what we think are the best albums necessarily of pre-2000. These are just some of Stan's favorites and we're doing a little battle with them. And then we've got 6 Feet Under Haunted versus Death Human.
Human.
By far Human.
I would pick 6 Feet Under, but that's just me. So you guys just keep going.
I thought about it for a split second.
Mm-hmm, okay.
It wasn't like it was a, you know.
I mean, yeah, I love 6 Feet Under, but I just feel like I don't think you can compare it to Death album.
I believe Haunted's the only one worthy of getting on any kind of list. I will say that, but.
We were America the Brutal. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's we'll talk about that later on.
It's like a guilty
on.
Pleasure metal CD.
That's more than that, but...
the Brutal.
Arch Enemy, Stigmata versus Burzum. Philosophum, whatever. Yeah. Arch Enemy, Stigmata.
The Arch Enemy.
I don't know, Burzum, here and there.
You got to be in the mood. Very good black metal.
It is, but again...
Yeah, it's like I'm in that mood 10% of the time.
There's not a lot of genres pre-2000, though. You got to understand. Black metal's kind of a
big one.
Yeah.
It's just me.
Talking about Burzum in specific.
Oh, okay.
Well. Yeah, I'm not talking black metal in specific. We got Carcass Reek versus Strife One Truth. I don't really like Reek.
Really?
I don't, that's a little more grindy for my taste. So grindy.
It's like a pivotal grindcore album.
Yeah. I'd rather listen to Scum all day.
Well, yeah, but this is inverse Scum.
No, I know, but for me, like, pivotal grind is like Scum. I can't really get into it.
I'm going to go Carcass.
I'm going Strife.
I have to go Carcass.
And then we've got Emperor Anthems of the Welcome. What is it?
Oh, I'm sorry, you got the handwritten one. I should be here.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Trade.
Then we've got Amper Anthems to the Welcome, Welkin at Dusk versus Bathory Under the Sign of the Black Mark.
I'm going Emperor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Bathory, but
yeah,
Emperor, I've listened to it more, I guess, is what it comes down to.
This next one's a pretty hard one.
Morbid Angel. Yeah. Altars of Madness, which is like such a classic, versus
the
classic Possessed Seven Churches.
I'm going Possessed all the
way. Me too.
Yeah.
I am more drawn to that like old school death metal sound than the more technical like Morbid Angel. I like Morbid Angel though. A ton. It's just, I find myself going more towards the Possessed and Entombed, Autopsy, and all that. Next, we've got Obituary, Slowly We Rot versus Marduk, Panzer. I'm going Obituary.
I agree.
Yeah.
For sure. Immortal at the Heart of Winter versus Enslaved Eld. That's a good matchup. That's
a tough one. Mm-hmm. I'm going Enslaved.
Enslaved.
I'm going Immortal.
Really?
Yeah, because Eld is not my favorite.
Really? That's like a classic. That's the first one I heard and just
it's good.
Stuck with me.
But Immortal's got way more of a kick, way more of a punch. Like that one I can throw on, put that on a blizzard and you're having a good day. If it was an older Enslaved or a newer Enslaved, I'd probably, you know, lean more towards that.
Yeah.
And then we've got Necrophagist Onset versus Carcass Heartwork.
Wait, didn't we have two Carcass albums?
Yeah, Stan broke his own rules.
Oh.
He's looking at them as two different bands. I understand.
How they're not like each other at all, but
I know. It is like two different bands.
I forgot the argument is legitimate.
I have to go Heartwork just because it's such a classic. But Necrophagist, that's a classic too. I guess I've just listened to Heartwork more.
Yeah,
I agree. I'll go
Carcass,
but yeah. I really used to love Necrophagist, so
I just didn't want to throw fucking Carcass on there twice, and we already elevated them before, so I, whatever, who cares? But
I don't think Reek's gonna make it to the end. We've got Suffocation, Effigy of the Forgotten versus Mayhem, D Mysterious, Dom Sathanas.
Effigy of the Forgotten.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Although Mayhem's a good one to throw on around like Halloween when you want to creep yourself out a little bit.
Alrighty. Well, we'll finish that up eventually, I guess, at some point.
We'll finish our March Metal in like June.
It's okay. I mean,
the basketball games are still on.
It's tonight. Today's Monday when we're recording this. They got the last one that's on, so it's whatever.
It doesn't matter.
It's fine. It's our time, not their time.
And then our Basis in Metal.
Yeah, let's get into this.
The neglected band member that never gets its due.
Sometimes you could do without, but with these guys, you definitely could not do without because they are an integral part.
Kind of hard to pick some. I mean, some really stand out, but yeah. Most are just following a top string of a guitar.
Which is unfortunate. Yeah. Now, I've been paying so much attention to Basis lately. It's like there's so much potential, and I feel like half the time it gets just lost in production. You don't have the producer, you don't have them in the mix, so like, how are you going to hear them? And then the other half of the time, they're just, like you said, they're following the guitar, so you're not going to hear that. But then again, you have some that you get the right mix, and they're doing something different, and that's when I think they stand out the most.
So, unfortunately, I believe we're going to probably have some overlap, because there is so little that do kind of stand out. I'm sorry, but that's kind of how it is.
And that's where I wanted to start then. So I guess I recognize the theme with my list, and it's a lot of new age.
Okay.
You know, people, new age bands, mm-hmm. You know, stuff more modern. So I guess that's my question to you guys was, do you guys have anybody that maybe would fall on the post 2000 list?
Yeah, for sure. Steve DiGiorgio is my big one. He's the one that made me start paying attention to bass in general. I'm talking Steve DiGiorgio from Autopsy, Severed Survival is where I first heard him. That mix is all bass drum and bass. So it just stands out. You can hear it. Like that's kind of why. But then you listen to him on Death, on Human, on Individual Thought Patterns. And the Individual Thought Patterns, again, the bass is raised way up in the mix, kind of shoddy, kind of like a Sun Eater where it's standing out and it's phenomenal. I mean, he really did some really cool runs. He does more of like a lead bass half of the time, you know? And that's one I want to play a little bit of a little clip on is Steve DiGiorgio, just because he's been in like 10 different bands. I feel like he's influenced so many other death metal bassists to try like different things. So I'm just going to play a little clip of this one so you guys can check them out. That song was Death, the Philosopher, the ending. The way it trades in and out with the solo between Chuck and the bass, and then it just kind of fades out. I feel like it's just a good standout for him.
I got one. I actually do got one pre-2000. Well, he's still going, though. He's a legend.
Yeah.
Alex Webster. But I mean,
that's on my list and too.
He doesn't. They don't have a lot of in-your-face bass parts. But it's just like you kind of you see what he does in videos. You see him mm-hmm. live. He's amazing bassist, and I see him more as like frontman of the band too.
Yeah,
you know, and he writes a lot of the parts and stuff. So
you get a lot of credit.
Yeah, it might not be in-your-face bass you hear, but
that's the thing though. Like he does so much good. So many good riffs. Mm-hmm. That's why I wish, like, where is he in the mix, you know?
Yeah.
But on Kill, if you listen back to Kill, because I was thinking about this, and I was like, I love Alex Webster's bass. Where, you know, where's a good example? If you listen to Kill, it's mixed evenly, at least.
Yeah.
It's not, like, higher, but it's in the mix, so you can hear it. It's such a talented bassist. And then Obscura, not that they're super old, but Jaron Paul Thesseling. This guy took like kind of what like Steve DiGiorgio was doing with the like fretless bass and all that. And I don't know, he really takes it to another level. He's not in the band anymore. That we've been talking about Obscura a little bit because they put out an album this year, Acroasis. And that was a really good album. I don't even know who plays bass on it, but it's really good bass. But I feel like he's modeling what he did after this guy. But I could be wrong. But Anti-Cosmic, I'm going to play this song. Just a clip of this. The lead work he does in it is amazing. Like it's, again, he's not following the guitar. He's totally, it's a lead bass part, which is, I think is awesome. Anti-Cosmic Overload.
Johnny?
The first person who actually made me, you know, pay attention to the bass, I guess, a little bit more was Dan Briggs from Between the Buried and Me.
Yeah.
That Viridian that little interlude before White Walls.
Yeah.
Yeah, where he has his little bass, you know, a cappella, where he's just doing whatever the hell he wants to do. And if you listen to, I mean, all of, you know, BT Bam, I mean, it's in there, and it isn't just model. I mean, at times, with the songs being how long they are, I mean,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? But yeah, he's a great bassist.
He really is, yeah.
I feel like that's where it does shine. It's like in progressive metal.
Well, and that's the thing. Yeah. And if you the theme of the bands that I'm going to show you, you know, have that element to them, like the River of Nils lead singer, yeah, bassist.
That's exactly what I have on my list too.
Yeah, Adam Briggs. He's an amazing bassist. It sticks out. It fits that, you know, Job for a Cowboy, Sun Eater, where it's, you know, it is. I mean,
it sounds like a fretless bass, but I don't think it is.
I don't think it. I mean,
but it's just mixed right. It's half the damn thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably a lot of bases we don't even hear.
No, you're exactly right. And it's like, it's almost like having a third lead there, and it's just that different tone. Mm-hmm. So,
and it's just in that progressive type of stuff. You know, you don't hear it in your more standard genres as much. It just doesn't stick out.
Exactly.
You get a chance to shine a little bit more.
Let's play Circles in the Sky off of their new album. What was that called, Jason?
Monarchy.
Yeah, that really highlights, you know, some of his bass. And I think mispronounced his name. It's Adam Biggs.
Because I was thinking Briggs,
Dan
too.
Briggs. So that's why I got confused, because Dan Briggs of Between the Buried and Me, Adam Biggs of Rivers of Nil.
Yeah, I got you.
The other one I got is Evan Brewer.
Nice. I'm glad you said that.
I know was in the Faceless. I'd never, I didn't get in that album. I knew him from Animosity and
Reflux.
Reflux and actually solo stuff was some of the first. Well, I always liked Animosity Animal, but his solo albums are phenomenal.
So good.
What's the one called? Your Itinerary?
I think he has one this year, too, maybe.
I have not listened to that one. I got really into Your Itinerary back in the day.
He's really good. Yeah. On Planetary Duality from The Faceless, and he was really good, but you have to listen kind of hard to hear it.
It's not mixed well.
Not as much as it should. Like, Michael's guitars are really what stands out.
Yeah.
But then on the one, Autotheism, it's a little bit higher, and I remember I liked it. Because you want to hear, it's like, dude, what a waste. Like, he's such a talented bassist. And then they did bring him up on Autotheism. But if you really want to hear him, you're right. Like, play anything from his solo material.
It's just bass and drums and it's, keyboards and stuff, but no guitars. So you can actually hear what his abilities, and he's just amazing.
I mean, it's like you're listening. You don't need it. You know what I mean?
No, exactly.
It's lead bass played really, really well. That stand out to me would be Beyond Creation, technical death metal band. Dominic Lapointe is his name. Really technical and really talented. He's not my favorite. I guess just because some of the other ones I mentioned, I like maybe their songwriting a little bit more or whatever. But this guy, a lot of talent, and he's always mixed super high just because it's a lead bass. You know what I mean? He's not doing the rhythm. And then Cynic, some of the early Cynic albums like Focus, I think, again, it's mixed high. If you're a bassist or if you want to hear some good metal bass, then I would throw that on. But then I know the last one, Shoddy, you're the one that kind of was big on this album to begin with, so.
Oh, you're talking about Nick from Job for a Cowboy? Yeah, that album is just, I mean, it's kind of what put bass back like on the map for me because it was lost for the longest. Well, after, the Colors thing happened. But yeah, I mean, I really didn't listen to it. And then I found myself wondering what that was when I heard the album for the first time.
It's like you didn't hear it mixed that high in a while.
Yeah, no, not, but yeah.
Besides, well, some of those death metal bands were here and there, but it's just not popular to have it mixed that high and for somebody to be playing that much lead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
No, and it's fucked up, actually, to hear. And it was kind of one of the reasons why the CD was so good, mm-hmm. was because it was like that. It just added that other layer of something else to listen to. And it, well, you get what I'm saying? Like, you can listen to the lead, you can listen to the rhythm, and you can listen to the drums and the vocals. Nobody ever fucking listens to the bass.
No.
Because it's just there.
Right.
And half the time you can't even tell, but this was pushed to the forefront. It didn't take away from anything else, but it was there in its own right. So
some, I've heard, like, most people think it was a good addition, a good change to Jaffa Cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
Some people I've heard say, you know, it's distracting, or
they didn't overdo it,
which
though.
Is crazy.
Yeah, like they did not overdo it by any means. Like, I could understand if it was that high pitched bass twang all the time,
yeah.
but when they throw it in there, it's tasteful. So
I agree, Stan. You got into this album, right?
Oh, I like this album. Yeah, I think Shadi actually got it for my birthday a couple years ago.
What do you, I mean, do you prefer having that bass in the mix like that?
Oh, yeah,
like
no, I think it's actually, I think it's a perfect mix between, you know, the whole music in a whole with the drums and everything. But yeah, I really do kind of like what Shadi says. It's actually, it was nice to hear that again. You don't hear a lot of that stuff ever, so.
If right. everybody did it, though, how do you think it
yeah.
would
be?
Yeah,
it'd
be
getting repetitive just like anything else, I think.
That's true.
You know,
why?
You really got to have
that's
talent.
That's my question. Why, though? If everybody, though, could play bass that, so if, you get what I'm saying, is if the level in every band was that, I just don't
question.
Think it works is the answer. Is it just doesn't work for every band.
No, it doesn't.
I guess you have to have the talent.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to just be like playing loud and technical just to have it out there.
Just, yeah, just for it to be there.
I mean, if you're following the rhythm of the guitar, then yeah, I don't want it to be at the forefront. But if you're able to do like what these guys that we've mentioned do, especially with where they, you're not the lead guitarist necessarily. You know, you can follow the band when you need to, just like a rhythm guitar, like, you know, you follow it and then you play your solos and your leads when you want to. That's why I think Nick is so good.
Oh yeah.
It's not like he's always soloing and playing crazy leads. Sometimes you don't notice it, and then he kicks in, he kicks out, he weaves around it. I think that's really cool. So I don't think everybody could do that. Do you know what I mean? Like, to your question, Charlie.
Yeah,
I don't
no,
think,
yeah.
You're right.
I'm just saying, if everybody did start doing it, yeah, it would probably just get repetitive. But you're right. Not everybody can do it because their music doesn't allow them to do that.
That's another thing, too. Depends what kind of genre it is.
Yeah.
Subgenre. You're not going to throw it out as high on like a straight, whatever, deathcore, thrash album, metalcore, you know, those kind of things. You're maybe not going to throw it like as high in the mix.
Yeah.
Because you don't have that room to breathe like you do on like a progressive metal album.
Mm-hmm.
I would say. Or like, I think it works best in like a technical death metal album or a progressive metal
album.
Yeah,
I agree.
Because it's like experimental.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But
yeah, that interview.
Yeah, so we have an interview with Nick who played bass. I'm not going to try to say his last name. It's Nick S. from Jaffa Cowboy. It's complicated.
Yeah. I looked at it. Sorry, Nick. I'm not going to try either.
Yeah. Nick Schizelandrio. Something
you
like that.
You said we weren't going to try.
he's the dude that really changed Jaffa Cowboy sound, I think, and added that fresh element. But he's also played bass in Cephalic Carnage, which, if you haven't checked them out, is also really, really good. More in the grind territory. But if their last album, you can hear his bass standing out actually quite a bit. And then he's also playing bass right now in Havoc. More of a thrash throwback kind of band. Also really good. So we'll just go ahead and let you guys listen to that.
So it's
you're out in Colorado, right?
Yeah, that's right. Over Colorado, Capitol Hill. Yeah, actually, I grew up in Evergreen, which is about 45 minutes west of Denver, up in the mountains, and then kind of bounced back and forth between here and Wisconsin as a kid. But then, you know, majority of my life I've been here, though.
Cool. So you're in three different bands right now. How do you manage to be in all three bands at once?
Kind of just luck, really. I mean, if they were all three full-time bands, I don't think it would be doable. But essentially what happened is I started playing with Fall of Carnage, and then our drummer John had a daughter, and he wanted to kind of be there for, you know, first steps and, you know, just kind of all of it. So he really kind of pulled back the touring. So we dropped down to probably, you know, from 7-8 months of touring down to like, you know, 1 or 2 months of touring. And then I wanted to keep playing live. So then I joined Dropbreak Cowboy, and we kind of just, they were doing about 6, 7, 8 months a year, plus a month or two of Cephalic. So it was about 10 months a year. And then Dropbreak Cowboy, our singer, kind of did the same thing. He just had a kid and he kind of wanted to pull back. So now Job's just doing minimal stuff. Spolik's doing minimal stuff. So then, you know, needed to join the third band. So Havoc's pretty much the primary, pretty much gets priority. If somebody, like if a Cephalic or a Job tour gets booked, then, you know, we'll work around it with Havoc, but essentially Havoc's going to be kind of the main gig.
Okay, yeah, so I guess, you know, with Havoc, you guys, from what I looked at online, you guys just got a pretty big tour, right, with Megadeth and Children of Bodom.
Yeah, it was incredible, man. Really amazing tour.
Now, were you guys playing, like, bigger arenas, or what were the size of these venues?
Yeah, the Megadeth stuff was anywhere from, you know, 1,500 cap rooms up to, you know, hockey arenas.
Wow.
You know, some of the, like, the last one we did in Quebec, it must have been, I don't know, 7,000-8,000 people or something like that. It was packed. It was crazy.
Wow. With Job, have you guys played any arenas that size before?
Job's never really done arenas that big, actually, but it's possible because they did do Gigantour.
Yeah, right.
When I did Job, we did Mayhem, which is like my second other biggest tour I've ever done. Mayhem's probably even bigger than Megadeth, but, you know, obviously you're talking about 20 bands as opposed to four. And, you know, it was like Rob Zombie and Five Finger Death Punch and Mastodon. And so you get those big four headliners that have a big draw, and then all the side stages and stuff. But all that stuff was outside. So we're kind of like, we were doing the side stages. So we're playing like, essentially, you know, you set up in parking lots, basically. And those we'd have around, you know, probably about an average of like 3,500 to 5,000 people when we were playing. So that was really, really cool too. A cool experience. But the Megadeth stuff was all inside. Nice venues, good sound, and just four bands. So it was more like a regular tour that you would have as opposed to this crazy, you know, traveling festival.
What do you prefer? You like playing those bigger ones, or do you like the smaller venues?
All of it's really cool. I mean, some of that, we did a show, the last show we did on the way home just to, you know, pay for gas and stuff, was this little place. It was like I forget what it was called, something Tap House in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was like a free show. No room on the stage at all. I literally didn't even play on the stage. So I just like played on the bar and shit. But it was, you know, 80 something people, and it was packed and super fun. So, you know, you take it kind of, there's benefits to all of it. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, you know, the variety is the spice, you know what I mean? But having the opportunity to be able to play the big, huge places and big ass crowds and really nice stages and all that stuff, that's definitely something I'm super grateful for.
I can't even imagine. I mean, like, you know, Megadeth, did you grow up listening to them at all?
Most definitely.
Yeah, that's got to be like bucket list territory or something there.
Most definitely bucket list stuff, dude. I mean, you know, I pretty much like, I pretty much use the Dave Mustaine voice every day. It's like, I always have, you know what I mean? Just as, I don't know, I like doing it and stuff. So it was sort of surreal to be on tour with them and, you know, be hanging out with them and drinking wine and all kinds of shenanigans.
Yeah, dude. So, So you came in the Job for a Cowboy back for Demonocracy, correct?
Actually, yeah. There's one before that. There's an EP I did called Gloom.
Okay. So you were there for the EP first.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So yeah, then
that was the first thing I ever did with them too. Before I played any shows or anything, just went right into recording. It's kind of interesting. It was cool though.
Now, how did you jump into the band?
Essentially, so I was doing some session bass work down in Arizona. At the time, this guy Al Glassman, I had toured with him before. Cephalic Carnage had done a tour with Despised Icon, and Al was in Despised Icon at the time. So we kind of got to know each other, and then just so happened to be doing some session work down in Arizona, and John Rice, the drummer, was down there, and I kind of told him, you know, we were both kind of we hit it off really well, and I had kind of told him that Cephalic had been slowing down and stuff, and just so happened, like, you know, a month later that the Brent, the bassist from Job, quit in the middle of a tour. So they called me up to try to do that, and I couldn't do it because Cephalic was going to Mexico. But I was like, yeah, you know, hit me up after after the tour, and we'll see what's up. And they hit me up, and they're like, yeah, we have a recording time booked and a BT BAM tour, and, you know,
yeah,
into it. We're down to work with Cephalic's schedule, so it ended up working great.
Cool, man. So, you know, listening back, you know, to those albums, going from Gloom up until Suneater. Suneater is what kind of made me and the other guys on the podcast really take notice. You know, we're like, who's this guy playing bass? Just because you don't hear a ton of that style, you know, besides some of the bigger names, you know, like the Steve DiGiorgios and, you know, those kind of bass players. So where did you get your style from? Where did you kind of come from? And, you know, how'd you develop as a bass player?
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, Suneater is probably my favorite stuff I've ever done. I'm actually in the process right now of relearning the songs because, you know, we hadn't toured or anything since Johnny had his kids. So we never toured on Suneater at all.
Wow.
And so it's been, you know, years since I've, you know, had to play any of those riffs or, you know, I mean, I listen to the record a lot, but I've never actually sat down and like, all right, I got to relearn all this stuff to play it live. So I'm in the process of doing that because we're playing a show in Vancouver on the 8th, the first show back with Job after, you know, almost 3 years or so. And, it's a bitch to learn.
I would imagine. Yeah. Cause yeah, never playing them live ever. That's insane.
Yeah. There's some tricky stuff in there, especially cause like Jason Sukoff at Audio Hammer and I, we were really, I wouldn't say experimental, but it was super hands-on. We were just like, really like, let's come up with the coolest. There was zero ego involved. It was just like, let's come up with the coolest bass part we can for this. So if I had anything already, you know, I was totally down with if he had an idea for something or if I had an idea. And we just kind of tried everything out, and that's sort of been one of my favorite things is to go into a studio and sort of develop something on the fly. There's like an improvisational aspect to that record in particular, Demon actually as well too, and some of the Cephalic stuff too. But that record, Suneater, was very improvisational in the studio, and I really like the turnout of it because I think that sort of developing yourself as a player can come from different influences. You know, obviously the guys that you grew up that maybe wanted you make you play the instrument in the first place. For me, you know, that was like when I first, you know, was getting into instruments and that kind of stuff. I was a guitar player, but always loved guys like Flea and Les Claypool and you know, Cliff Burton, Jason Newsted, those type of dudes.
Yeah.
And then as I, you know, there was one band, it was Ryan Martini from Mudvayne, the record LD50. That was the record that made me decide to be a bassist. So that, you know, it's kind of interesting that you have those type of dudes and you sort of like, then you get into some of the super guys, like, you know, then I've got really into Victor Wooten, Jaco Pastorius, but, you know, more Victor Wooten, like Michael Manring, mm-hmm. Marcus Miller, those type of dudes. And then you find guys like Rob Trujillo, and I guess you sort of just take a little, you know, you find something that you like about the person and maybe you pick up one of their techniques. I would never really learn people's full songs, but I would just, you know, oh, that technique's really cool. And I'd pick up the technique and kind of take it and kind of make it yours. But one of my favorite things though, is to be influenced by like producers. You know what I mean? Like these, I had an opportunity to work with Sukoff and there's another guy, Dave Otero, and they're such good musicians. But the best part about it is though, that their job is to, you know, steer the performances and the actual parts that are played to making better records. And I feel like a part of that comes from, you know, having that sort of lack of ego to where you'll, you know, listen to these people, you know, what this, you know, like my bass lines are forever changed because Jason Sukoff, you know, like he influenced the way I think about bass differently because he'd be like, hey, what if it was something like this? And I'd be like, oh shit, that shape's super weird. I've never played that before.
Yeah.
And it was hard. And like, it takes forever to get the take, but then that shape is now with me forever. You know what I mean? And so those are some kind of cool things that I would, you know, recommend to other players is to really get into, you know, if you get the opportunity to work with a really great producer, that's a great player. You know, there's a lot of them out there that aren't players and they have their cool sort of third party perspective on what makes a great bass line and how that helps the song and glues the drums and the guitars. But if you can find a great producer, that's a great player. That can be a huge influence on your playing in a really positive, way.
Right. Yeah, that totally makes sense. So when you guys went in there with Jason to make this album, you know, since it's such a different sounding album from the rest, like, did you guys, you know, you said you did a lot of improvisation, but did you guys really have like the mindset of we're going to really just go for a lot of progression with this? And, you know, like with your bass, did you guys have that planned out to really make a, to kind of make it more of a lead bass playing, you know, compared to maybe some of the other albums?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we kind of, we really kind of did. We had a concept in mind for the album, like a year and a half before we made it. And that really helped steer things along because we had specific moods that we knew we wanted to make, you know, like a story that we wanted to make. And so that sort of lent itself to the writing process. Like they would put the guitars together and write these parts together to sort of tell the story. And this is before lyrics or anything, but we just kind of knew the overall feel of what we wanted to do and the feel of the ride that we wanted to make the album take you on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going into the studio and stuff, you know, we knew we wanted to have this sort of, I don't want to say like stripped down, you know, but if you compare it to Demonocracy, it's definitely, you know, half the riffs.
For sure. Yeah.
We wanted to sort of get away from the riff mansion thing. And, you know, we could tell that, you know, it was sort of like Demonocracy and Gloom in themselves and even Ruination and potentially Genesis, but from Ruination on forward, there's a really strong effort you could tell, I think, and at least from an objective perspective, that they had to get rid of this deathcore moniker.
Right.
You know? And in order to do that, you got to play incredibly, you know, technical death metal riffs and make sure you don't have any breakdowns and or pig squeals. Or they really wanted to disassociate themselves from that whole scene.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, as a result of that, you ended up getting sort of technicality for technicality's sake, you know, like it was less about, you know, serving the song. And so with Sun Eater, we definitely wanted to do that. And Johnny is also a huge fan of the LD50 record too. So we kind of wanted to have that. I went in knowing I'm like, I'm not using a Sans amp. I'm going just straight direct, clean bass. And like, I wanted that tone and I'd pretty much gotten it before we went into the studio. I had this one bass and I was like, dude, this is the tone. So it was really cool to be able to nail that and have Jason be into it. And then have the other guys be cool with the bass being that level in the mix, because, you know, it could have gotten buried in the mix and then would just been a freaking big waste of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Like most metal albums really are.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that I would get to that point before you record and, you know, you put all this work into making these really cool technical bass parts. And then if it gets buried, it's like, well, dude, if you're just going to bury it, then I'll just play something really simple.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like, might as well just, you know what I mean? So it was really, really cool and gratifying for me to be able to have it, like, where, like, you don't have to dig with, you know what I'm saying? Like, here to, like, where's the bass at again? Most metal records, you got to be like, what's the bass doing?
Yeah.
I love that I don't do that. Like, it's there. You know, you can hear every freaking note, you know?
For sure. So have you guys done any writing at all for the next Japra Cowboy album?
Yeah. Tony's got about 4 songs that he put together. I've got stuff, but it's kind of one of the interesting things about being in, you know, 3 bands is when you write something, you know, you're like, okay, who does this belong to? You know?
Right.
Like which band is this for? So I've got stuff. Like I've got like, probably a bunch of stuff. I probably have 4 or 5 songs worth of material myself. But I'm like, is this Symphonic or is this, you know, Job for Cowboy or?
Sure.
If I throw a, you know, a DB behind it, is it Havoc stuff? It's super like kind of weird, but we definitely have a plan to do another record. Johnny wants to like get it done pretty quick and it'll be sort of like a, not a sequel, but it'll be a follow-up to Sun Eater. So it'll be in the same vein of things. Hopefully even a further progression past that, you know?
Sure.
We, you know, I was really actually, you know, really disappointed that we didn't get the tour on that record, you know, especially because kind of like I said, you know, they really worked really hard to try to get rid of that, you know, oh, Job for Cowboy? Oh, you mean the guys with the swoop haircuts, the, you know, wearing their sister's jeans and the whole scene thing and deathcore and, like they worked really, really hard for, you know, 10 years to get rid of that.
Yeah.
And this wreck did it. And then no touring, you know, so it's like, it's sort of like you get what you want and then you, you know, well, I can't do it. You know, I can't tour right now. So I was pretty disappointed on it, but, that we didn't get the tour for it. So I'm pretty, pretty stoked to actually finally be going and playing this stuff. And since I've learned all the songs again and I'm going to have them tight, I'm going to probably do some playthroughs and that kind of stuff. And hopefully all of that we'll get the energy kind of sparked up in everybody so that we can definitely go work towards doing a follow up towards it. Cause I would love to keep writing that style of music. I really dig it. You know, it's super fulfilling for me. So,
well, I really think it makes you guys stand out too. Like you said, with the other albums, it's great, you know, technical death metal, but you know, it doesn't necessarily stand out like this album, like Sun Eater did. It really seemed, you know, you guys kind of carved a little more of your own path, which that's why I think it really stuck with so many people.
Wow. Thanks, man. Yeah. That's, I'm in agreement with you, we're humbled by the response we got to it, because we didn't really know. I mean, it's kind of like when it was finished, we were all like, damn, this is really, I really, really like this. But every band, every time you finish a record, you're like, this is awesome, right? You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like one of those things where you're like, well, let's see what happens, you know, because we know the internet can be a pretty cruel place. You know?
Yeah.
For an artist to go see how his art is received. But yeah, we were blown away by the response we got, and it's been really cool.
Why do you think, I mean, just this off question with that, you know, with the whole being kind of like thrown off as a deathcore band, I mean, it seems crazy to me that you guys, or, you know, the band before you were joined, put out Doom, it was an EP, and then immediately after that, you know, the band tried to shed that, and every album since then has been nothing to do with deathcore. Why do you think people hold that to you guys so much?
I think it was probably because probably the time frame and the level of which of the success and notoriety they achieved for it. You know, it was really like the first band, and I saw it from an external perspective in Safal. Like, you know, we even had a job. I mean, we even had a song about Chow where we were mentioned. You know, like it was sort of like a diss on the band and that kind of stuff. And
really?
Yeah, totally. Because we're like, you know, this kid, it's like the first band to really get big from MySpace.
Yeah,
they didn't have a record. It was like put four or five songs up, and all of a sudden, you know, you're on, you know, bills, you know, five times higher slots than bands that have five records out that have really legitimate, you know,
sure,
legitimately put in 20 years worth of work and stuff. So it was sort of like this, you know, this explosive new trend. It was just this trend, you know, that just they really did kind of explode out of nowhere. And so I feel like they got such notoriety for that I think that it polarized people right off the bat. Either people really loved it or really, really, really hated it. And then, you know, every time you'd see the name again, right, you know, I don't think people would even give it a chance to actually listen to the record. They're just like, oh, John Furcali, no thanks. You know what I mean? I'm not into shitty deathcore, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that played a big part into it. And for whatever reason now, this record, you know, I guess got the right kind of, you know, I don't know how we got people to listen to it, to actually check it out and listen to it.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
I remember even asking Johnny when I joined Job for Cowboy, I was like, how the fuck did you, you know, get so, how did you do this with the MySpace thing? How did you get so popular out of nowhere? And he doesn't know.
Right.
He's literally like, dude, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Probably some rando luck of the draw. Who knows? Maybe it was like some MySpace bot, you know, that just would repopulate the page and so it looked like there was a million of views and there wasn't. I don't know what the hell.
Yeah.
Who freaking knows?
Right. Whatever, it worked. But I mean, yeah, it's cool that you guys are on the path you are now. So what kind of bass is out there now, specifically like in metal? Is there anybody that you kind of look at as like, not necessarily inspirational, but doing things that, you know, we should pay attention to in modern metal that you can think of?
Yeah. I mean, God, you know, I'm about to go see him right now as a really good friend of mine. But if you know, if anybody out there hasn't checked out Evan Brewer's stuff, specifically the Entheos record, there's a full length Entheos that just came out.
Now you're talking to Evan from the Faceless before, correct?
Faceless, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A new band now called Entheos with Naveen, you know, drummer from Animals as Leaders, former drummer from Animals as Leaders, and then one of the Animosity guitarist, and then Naveen's girl Chaney, and he's doing the double thumb thing for all the, like the entire record. It's sick, dude. I mean, he's like, you know, we'll sit down and play, and when I play next to that guy, like I feel like putting my shit down and being like, I gotta wait, man.
Yeah.
I gotta go home and practice for 4 or 5 years straight with the metronome to try to come anywhere near where that kid's at. So he's doing incredible shit. That Forrest, what's his name? Forrest, I can't remember what his last name is, but he plays for, I want to say it was Beyond Creation. That kid is incredible.
incredible fretless player. Really, really, really cool stuff. And then, let's see, I'm trying to think who else has done some really, really cool stuff. Mark Mitchell's doing some really cool stuff. Scale the Summit. Really
sick. Mm-hmm. What about, did you ever, because the first time I kind of started paying attention to bass and metal was those older dudes like Steve DiGiorgio or, you know, like In Death or even like Obscura, those kind of things. Did you ever get into anything with that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, DiGiorgio is like the Death Human. I've still been trying to get my hands on the Death Human drum and bass. You know, like, I guess they were, there's, it's released out there. I don't know where the hell to find it, but they had got actual drum and bass tracks and exported it and made a, you know, Death Human drum and bass.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's supposed to be friggin' incredible because you could just, you know, it's a totally different record when you hear it without the guitars and vocals and stuff. And then, yeah, Jeroen Thiesling from Obscura and, what the hell is he doing now? But, yeah, he's a freaking incredible, amazing player too. And some of those guys have like kind of really set the bar. Who's the other guy? What was the guy's name from Atheist?
Oh, I don't know his name, but that's the other band I was thinking of.
Yeah. And that's the crazy part is there's guys that have literally been doing this thing with, you know, the bass is an equally important melodic voice in a technical, you know, metal context, you know, which requires a pretty high level of technical proficiency on the instrument, you know?
Yeah.
So that's cool that those guys get, you know, I mean, obviously Alex Webster too. Webster's super, super sick. And
right on.
Yeah, there's so many rad bassists out there that I don't think are even getting the credit that they should be. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's why we want to do this episode and talk about some of them. Cause there really is. I mean, I wish there was more of it. Cause when you do hear it, it's so badass. I don't understand why you don't get more of that, you know, in metal. It's, but I'm glad that, you know, guys like you are doing it for sure.
Yeah, thanks. I think a big part of it is that as a bassist, you know, A, you got to find guys that are willing to have the bass be up in them. A, you got to find guys that are willing to let the bass be that busy in the first place.
That's true.
And then B, you need to find guys that are willing to have the bass be up in the mix so that people can actually hear it. And then C, I think that, you know, there is definitely an element to, you know, needing to learn the aspect of the industry where of marketing yourself. You know, you have to learn how to market yourself. I mean, for any musician, any days, anybody doing any kind of art or any kind of business period, you have to learn how to market yourself. And I think that, you know, a big part of that, at least, you know, success for me, a lot of it came from, I think, from focusing on like YouTube videos.
Right. Okay.
Stuff like that, like where you have an opportunity to, you know, if you get into the band, and then, you know, your band lets you post your weirdo YouTube videos or at least just playthroughs of your stuff. Then, you know, you can kind of sort of develop a demand for yourself or at least like an awareness of you as a player, you know? So that's kind of one thing I think that some guys, could benefit from because I guarantee you there's guys out there that are 10 times, you know, sicker than anything I've ever done. That just don't have those little elements to be like, well, how did you get your name out there? How do people find it? And then get into the right bands. And then that's an element I would pay attention to as well, you know?
So, just to finish off, man, what's next? Like for, I want to know for Cephalic and, you know, for Job for a Cowboy, I know you mentioned, you know, your writing and all that, but what you got for, as far as touring goes or recording for Cephalic, anything going on with all that?
Yeah, definitely. Yep. I just heard a new Cephalic song, yesterday. So the whole, I was, you know, doing out for about 2 months doing that, Megadeth thing and Brian and Steve and John have been getting together and putting some stuff together. There's about 5 tracks or something like that worth of material. And they've actually just solidified the first like full structure of a song.
Nice.
And I heard it and it's fucking awesome. It's super cool. It's nice. Totally, it's like, it reminds me, there's parts that remind me of stuff off Anomalies. There's stuff that is like definitely Lucid Interval inspired. There's stuff that's less even. It sounds like older Cephalic to me. It's super spastic and crazy in parts. Like this part literally made me laugh out loud. I was just like, it was funny. I was like, all right, cool. This is gonna be sweet. So we're looking at hopefully maybe trying to record before the end of the year, which would be really cool. We kind of are still getting tour offers and stuff, but it's sort of far and few between because we haven't put a record out in 6 years. So it's really important to us that we, and, you know, to our fans and stuff too, but to us as, you know, artistically to get something out, to get something, a new product to push, to have some new songs to play.
Sure.
So we'll be working on that. Yeah, for Cowboy, I'm going to doing this Vancouver. It's called the Modified Ghost Festival. We're playing the I think it's called the Vogue Theater, April 8th, and it's Dillinger headlining, and then us,
nice,
and then Revocation and Gorod, and one other of our friends' band is playing. I can't remember. It might be Rivers of Nile. I can't remember. But so that's gonna be super cool. And then let's see. And then we may do some other stuff. I don't know. We'll see. We're trying to work it out with Johnny.
Yeah.
Because he's sort of like, you know, he kind of wants to make another record instead of touring. And so we're kind of like, all right, well, we're playing around with that.
Yeah.
Stuff. Havoc. Then so as soon as I get back from Vancouver, I go right to California, and we're gonna go record with Steve Evitz with Havoc. Steve Evitz has done all the Dillinger Escape Plan records.
Right. Yep.
And I'm a fan of those guys. And that's gonna be really cool too, because Steve's a bass player.
Oh, that's awesome!
Like a good bass player. So I'm really looking forward to that, seeing what his brain does to my bass lines. You know what I mean?
Right.
So go to record with him, and then Havoc goes straight out to Europe, and we're doing about 5 weeks, a bunch of really cool festivals: Download Festival, Hellfest, With Full Force, Tuska, a bunch of killer festivals. And then all the off dates we're doing with Megadeth.
Oh, nice.
It's going to be really cool. So, and those will be direct support, just us direct support to Megadeth, just the two bands, which will be really cool as we get to play longer. And we already kind of know the guys now, and it's really cool. So then, we'll get home from that. And then, there's some other talks of doing we have some other potentially really big things going on with Havoc from pretty much like August through the end of the year. The record will be coming out probably around October-ish or something like that. So that shit's going to be really, really cool. And then there's a couple other projects. I've had these songs I've been tossing back and forth with Ryan Martini, actually. This is like two bass, metal-ish kind of thing. And then, just kind of trying to balance and all the juggling and selling my house in the middle of it. Trying to, you know, keep my girlfriend happy.
Right.
Pet my cat. Right. All that kind of stuff.
Awesome, man. Well, really appreciate it. I hope you guys play a little. I hope I get to see Sun Eater sometime live, some of those songs. So you got to convince Johnny to get on the road for that a little bit.
Yeah, most definitely, man. I think hopefully, you know, everything goes real smooth with this weekend. I know we're going to have a blast with it. And hopefully it'll kind of get a bug in him again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. So
he's just like, you know, he's going to school full time, working full time, and he's got, you know, a 7-month-old.
Yeah, right.
It's just like, man, touring just doesn't fit with all this right now. So we're kind of like, well, what if it was just on the weekends or something like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We'll figure something out. But hey, man, I really want to thank you for the opportunity, man. I appreciate it. Anytime I get the chance to talk bass.
Yeah, right, man. Well, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. Good luck with everything you got coming up.
Thanks, dude.
All right, man. Later, Nick.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Nick, for sitting down with Jason and doing that interview. We hope you listeners out there enjoyed it.
Let us know your favorite bassist.
Yeah, please. If there's anybody that we left out, I'm sure that there is. Tweet us. You know, all the normal social media outlooks. I think that's it for this week, though. I'm Shoddy.
Jason.
Stan Man.
And that was another episode of Into the Combine. Stay metal. We'll be right back.
We are going down. As the carpet bends, he's on the way.